The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, January 2018, Volume 19, Number 1. And this is the first of three installments of the January issue. Because of last week's freezing weather and dusting of snow, many of your readers here at the Reading Service couldn't get into the studio. So we'll try to squeeze all of January into three installments this month. Oprah lounges on a deck chair on the deck of a Holland America Line cruise ship on this month's cover, with a bit of blue sea showing in the background and surrounded by deck chairs with blue cushions. Oprah shines in an orange and yellow windbreaker. The big white O for Oprah magazine sits on a royal blue background in the upper left-hand corner of the cover. This month's headlines are Time to Hit Refresh and How Asking the Right Questions Can Set You on a Whole New Course. And when we open the magazine, we have another picture from the deck of this ship. This time, Oprah is standing with the crew. Everyone's decked out in their uniforms and their white hats with the black patent leather visors and the gold embroidered leaf pattern, kind of a medallion, right above the visor. So we're on the bow of the ship looking into the Alaskan Mountains. Oprah's at the front of this upside-down V, as I said, and all the women have trench coats, sort of pale beige trench coats over their uniforms, and all the men have darker trench coats. And the headline on this interior page is, Here's to Smooth Sailing in 2018. And when we look inside the magazine at the Behind the Scenes page, first off, we have a picture of Adam Glassman and fashion editor Jenny Capitan helping Oprah get ready for this shoot with her trench coat and her hat, which I'm sure she's borrowed from one of the crew members, kind of jauntily cocked a little to one side. And the caption reads that Jenny and Adam make sure our cover model looks shipshape. Oprah's wearing a trench coat from Brooks Brothers and a sweater from 525 America. The sweater is a V-necked navy blue and white horizontal striped sweater. And then the earrings are from Roberto Coin. And then we have how you can get this look. A trench coat from J. Crew for $300 is shown here, and it's from netaporter.com. We have some espadrilles from Tommy Hilfiger, and they're a flat espadrille with the rope detail around the sole, and these are navy blue and white striped. And then they have a bucket bag that looks like it's white canvas with a giant oversized navy blue anchor applique to it. The bucket bag is $120, and it's from seabags.com. And topping that off are some aviator-style glasses from Salt, $490, and you can find them at nordstrom.com. Except the lenses are surrounded by a really thin, it appears to be, tortoise shell. Sailmates, that's S-A-I-L, mates. Oprah discovers that cruising really floats her boat. It was all hands on deck as Oprah joined the crew of the MS Uridam to shoot this month's cover in breathtaking Glacier Bay National Park during O's spectacular Share the Adventure cruise. The Holland America Line excursion was an adventure indeed for Oprah. It was her first commercial cruise. She's a fan, judging by the two enthusiastic tequila toasts she made at dinner. And first trip to the Alaskan wilderness, where she got up close and personal with American bald eagles. She said, how fantastic, as she was looking at the snow-capped mountains. Going on to say, now this is what I call expanding your horizons. And on a side panel here. It says, cruisin'. Back in March, we invited you to enter to win passage on our Share the Adventure cruise, a 7-day voyage to Alaska with Holland America Line. After reading 10,000 eloquent essays about travel and connection, we chose three lucky women to join us. Barbara Nash, Catherine Beatty, and Angela Halsey, who are pictured here with Oprah. They all got to spend quality time with Oprah. Nash says, quote, I still can't believe I sat shoulder to shoulder with her at dinner. She held my hand and made me feel like an old friend. And we shared dessert, baked Alaska. And then finally, we're taking a voyage of discovery and you could win two tickets. Ready for your adventure? O is partnering with Holland America Line to send one lucky winner and his or her guest on a 7-day adventure of your life cruise to the Caribbean, setting sail from Fort Lauderdale, October 28th. O editors and thought leaders from Oprah's Super Soul 100 will provide inspiration on this unforgettable journey. Learn more and enter for your chance to win at oprah.com/paradisecruise. And that is open until January 15th, so you have 5 more days to get your chance to win. And here we go from Oprah. We have a big picture of Oprah and Gail standing up in one of the top viewing decks of the MS Eurodam. And they're both looking out the window with binoculars held up to their glasses. Looking out there, with Gail aboard Holland America Line's MS Eurodam on O's 2017 Share the Adventure cruise to Alaska. Oprah says, what's the best way to live a full, honest, examined life? Where do we find deeper meaning? How can we bridge the gap between ourselves and others, especially when it seems wider than ever? The answer in every case, ask the right questions. This magazine has always had a searching spirit, and in 2018, we're bringing that spirit front and center, cultivating curiosity and finding new routes to know ourselves and one another. We're calling it the Year of Big Questions. What defines you? What are you willing to stand up for? In what or whom do you believe? We'll be going deep with the help of some brilliant thinkers. You can hear my interviews with them on my new Super Soul Conversations podcast, available for free at applepodcasts.com/Oprah. Some of our exploration will be geared toward our inner lives. Some will focus on the world beyond our front doors. I hope all of it will help propel you forward. Speaking of moving forward, after 7 years, we're retiring our May We Help You section. But if you're looking for Martha Beck, Lisa Kogan, or any other trusted O advisor, don't worry. They'll still be helping you live your best life in our Live Your Best Life section. We're also expanding our Feeling Good pages to include a brand new wellness section called Refresh, full of ideas to energize you daily. It's our way of evolving with you, getting better as we go. Ready to dive in? I hope the answer is yes. Enjoy, Oprah. And here's another change in the magazine. Under this title, Force for Good, on a side note, it says, all year, we'll be spotlighting people whose curiosity led them to make a positive change in their world. We're calling them Forces for Good, and you'll find the first one in this issue. And let's see what Farnoosh Torabi has to say, since she's been moved from May We Help You to Live Your Best Life. And the heading is called Lessons Earned. O's financial expert, Farnoosh Torabi, asks Baked by Melissa co-founder Melissa Ben-Ishay how she started her cupcake empire and how you can cook up a business plan of your own. Farnoosh says, I've always been fascinated by tales of entrepreneurs who hit it big, and Melissa Ben-Ishay's story is a doozy. After losing her corporate job in the thick of the 2008 recession, she turned to what she knew best and loved most, cupcakes. In her spare time, Ben Ishe had been busily baking for friends and family, she says, for as long as I can remember. Within a week of co-founding her company, she had her first official order. Almost 10 years later, her business, Baked by Melissa, is a beloved purveyor of bite-sized cupcakes, with 13 retail outlets and approximately 30 million treats distributed in 2017 alone, and a recently released cookbook, Cakes by Melissa, to boot. Whether or not you're handy with a whisk, Ben Ishe's journey is an inspiring peek into what it takes to build a thriving business. I asked the cupcake queen to share her triumphs and stumbles, plus the revelations that propelled her to sweet success. Take us back to the day you lost your job. And Melissa says, it was the worst. I remember being called to HR on a Wednesday at 11 a.m., thinking I was getting a promotion. Afterward, I called my brother, now my business partner, in tears. He said, don't worry, this is the best thing that ever could have happened. Now go home and bake your cupcakes. I made 250 that night and gave some to my friend's little sister, who had an internship at a big PR firm. Her boss ended up loving them and put me in touch with her caterer, who invited me to his house for a tasting. Eventually, he ordered hundreds. Fanoush says, why such tiny cupcakes? And Melissa says, we knew we needed to be different, and we wanted to give everyone a chance to try every flavor without the post-dessert guilt trip. All our cupcakes have fewer than 50 calories apiece. Plus, when I started the company at the end of the recession, people weren't spending a lot, and ours cost just $1 each. Farnoosh says, what money memories do you have from growing up? Melissa says, my parents tried to instill financial responsibility in me at an early age. I babysat, worked at birthday parties, and always saved. I had friends who had more than I did, and it was natural to compare myself to them and be jealous. But my mom always said, you're beautiful. You don't need those extra things. And somehow I believed her. Farnoosh says, so you can start a business without a ton of money? And Melissa says, sure, but don't quit your day job right away. Do it on the side first. That's how our product was developed. Before I got laid off, I was making cupcakes at home for fun. Every day, do one small thing to keep moving the idea forward. And along the way, get rid of any debt, so it'll be easier to get loans. Farnoosh says, what are the financial lessons you learned from starting a business? And Melissa says, you never know when something will go wrong. Case in point, we opened a dedicated gluten-free location, and after almost a year, the sales wouldn't support the rent. We had to act quickly. So we closed the shop and instead offered gluten-free options in our other stores. If you can't recognize when you've made a mistake and learn from it speedily, it can be detrimental, especially if it's costing money. Farnoosh says, are you a saver or a spender? And Melissa says, I'm a liver. I'd rather experience things than buy them. I pretty much wear one of three hooded sweatshirts every day, but I pay for a personal trainer who makes me feel great from the inside, and I love printing pictures for my scrapbook. To me, that's priceless. I'm often so busy that I don't have time to spend money, which works out pretty nicely. Yesterday, I had to email myself a reminder to buy moisturizer. I get my daughter ready for school, go to work, and give 110%, then do it all over again. Farnoosh asks, but is there something you'd be happy to splurge on? And Melissa says, I start every morning unloading my dishwasher, so having someone come over to clean my house is definitely one of my ultimate life goals. And Farnoosh's final question, what's your key advice for aspiring business owners? And Melissa's reply, surround yourself with people who support you and have skills different from yours. My brother had more entrepreneurial experience than I did, and we got help with our website and packaging design. Keeping an eye out for new ways to attract customers is also important. That's how Baked by Melissa got to where we are. We're self-aware, we're motivated, and we got stuff done. And the picture of Melissa shows her in sort of pale teal short sleeve top, and she's standing in front of an island in a kitchen. And it really looks like a kitchen in a home, not a commercial kitchen. And it's white countertops and white tile, and it's a nice sort of pecan wood finish on the modern sleek cabinets, and there's a great big stand mixer in the background. But on this island, there are a few cake pedestals with these tiny cupcakes on them, and they are in lots and lots of bright colors and with plenty of chocolate sprinkled in there as well. Now we have a column that says, by the numbers. Baked by Melissa has 250 employees in the U.S. Cupcakes sold daily at Baked by Melissa's original New York City flagship store is 3,000 to 5,000. Her sales of cakes and cupcakes at U.S. retail bakeries in 2016 was $532 million. The expected average annual increase at sales at U.S. retail bakeries between 2016 and 2021 is expected to be 7.2%. So finally, Farnoosh Tarabi is a personal finance expert, the author of When She Makes More, and the host of CNBC's Follow the Leader and the award-winning podcast, So Money. We'll skip over now to the reading room and look at 10 titles to pick up now. And the first one is They Can't Kill Us Until They Kill Us by Hanif Abdurraqib. From his analysis of racism in Ohio mosh pits to his account of attending a Springsteen concert after visiting Michael Brown's memorial in Ferguson, Abdurraqib represents a bold new voice in socio-music criticism. The second title, We Were Strangers Once, by Betsy Carter. Big-hearted and epic in scope, this novel traces the intertwined fates of European immigrants cobbling together uncertain lives in World War II-era Manhattan, having slipped the Führer's grasp, only to grapple with backbreaking work and the rising threat of American nativism. The third title is Mrs. Osmond by John Banville. In an audacious sequel to The Portrait of a Lady, Banville reimagines James' protagonist, Isabel Archer Osmond, an American expatriate adrift among moneyed elites in Europe, as she forges her own identity and flees the cruel prison of her marriage. The fourth title is The Vanishing Princess by Jenny Diskey. A literary lioness gone too soon, British writer Jenny Diskey, 1947 to 2016, drew on fairy tales and sharp-edged realities in her lone volume of short stories, rich with caustic wit and playful invention. The fifth title is I Wore My Blackest Hair by Carlina Duan. Quote, my English is hot, pursuing me with a gun, end of quote, ends the title poem in this defiant debut collection, a bare-knuckled reckoning with diaspora, identity, and thrillingly language itself. The sixth title is The Last Girl by Nadia Murad. In 2014, the Islamic State took over the Iraqi town of Kocho, massacring the Yazidi men who refused to convert to Islam and women too old to be sex slaves. One 20-year-old dared to find a way out, and now she's chronicled her terrifying journey from ISIS captive to lauded human rights activist. The seventh title is Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder by Caroline Fraser. This vibrant, meticulously assembled biography celebrates and demystifies the cherished author, plumbing the origins of Wilder's creativity and her fascinating pre-Little House careers as a farming columnist and an advocate for rural women. The eighth title is The Wine Lover's Daughter by Anne Fadiman. In this warm, nimble memoir focused only on the writer's delightfully snobbish father, critic, and onophile Clifton Fadiman, it would be worth the price of admission. But it's about so much more: the craft of writing, Jewish assimilation, the civilizing effects of hedonism, and of course, vino. The ninth title, The Revolution of Marina M. by Janet Fitch. St. Petersburg, 1916. Marina, a passionate, impressionable poet from an aristocratic family, got swept up in young love and the Bolshevik movement in the resplendent third novel from the White Oleander author. And our tenth and final title is Madison Park, A Place of Hope by Eric L. Motley. Motley, a former special assistant to George W. Bush, has written a wry, nostalgic memoir of the aspirational African-American community where he grew up, recalling its quirky neighbors and feisty pride amid the tensions of racially charged Alabama. Let's take a look now at the Live Your Best Life section of the magazine. And the big photograph on the very first page this month is in a recording studio, and we have a young African-American woman here, eyes closed, mouth open, like she's singing her heart out into a big professional recording studio microphone. And the quote is from Vincent van Gogh: "I am seeking, I am striving, I am in it with all my heart." And when we turn the page, we have the gratitude meter for January 2018. Five things we're smiling about this month, from awe to awesome. Coming in at awe, personal baggage. Have face will travel. Customizable head case luggage covers, available in three sizes. Can be printed with any picture. A smiley selfie, a close-up of your chihuahua, a cheeky tribute to your boss, virtually eliminating the chance that someone will walk off with your wheelie by mistake. And go to firebox.com, and they show a piece of rolling luggage here with Oprah's face. Oprah's face is filling the entire side of this piece of luggage. And then our next item, the second one, is surround sound. Did you know composer John Williams of Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind fame played piano on the movie version of West Side Story? Or that the Lord of the Rings soundtrack was recorded at Abbey Road Studios? The documentary Score pays homage to the brilliance of the film maestros who make our eyes well up and our hair stand on end. Go to score-movie.com. And right in the middle, between awe and awesome, more than welcome. Tiny Doors ATL makes nooks more enchanting and crannies more magical. This community arts project installs elaborate miniature portals, like a pebble pathway leading to red double doors, all around Atlanta, and every new ground-level entry gets its own ribbon-cutting ceremony. No jumbo scissors required. TinyDoorsATL.com. And the one shown here is very elaborate. It's red double doors, and it has a white surround with a lintel that looks carved. And the scale is very interesting because there's a hand holding a miniature roller dipped in red paint. So I'm guessing the doors might be 5 or 6 inches tall. And now, our next item, Long Strange Trips. March 27th, Marvel at Marbled Sandstone Dunes, shown here in Arizona. December 18th, explore a chapel adorned with human bones at the Czech Republic. This year, you can discover off-the-beaten-path peculiarities sans passport with Atlas Obscura's tear away calendar. Go to workman.com. And finally, the bigger picture. A glittery portrait of Cynthia Dawson's beloved daughter, Ava, who's shown here, who died of brain cancer in 2012 at age 5. She inspired Dawson's nonprofit, the Gold Hope Project. It pairs pediatric cancer patients and survivors with photographers who snap pictures free of charge. Help a family make memories at goldhopeproject.com. And at the bottom of this page, under Pet Project, this is the Creature Comfort section. If your 2018 goals include giving, consider supporting some of the 6.5 million cats and dogs placed in U.S. animal shelters annually. We asked Inga Frick, Director of Pet Retention Programs for the Humane Society of the United States, for the best ways to help four-legged friends in need. And here are the three ways. Think beyond the chew toy. Animal shelters always need the basics, clean towels, catnip, stuffed mice, but they require less obvious items too. Frick says, quote, hot dogs and peanut butter are regularly used for dog training, and office items are often in short supply, end of quote. Ask your local rescue about its top priorities and give generously. And the second item, show off your skills. Frick says, quote, shelters will put your occupational expertise to great use, end of quote. Lawyers are able to review adoption contracts. Carpenters or even adept IKEA assemblers can build agility equipment. And a shutterbug's portraits of Welsh corgis and Maine coons help beautify pamphlets and promotional materials. And finally, post with a purpose. If you're likes-minded, use some of your daily Instagram time to give adoptable animals more visibility. Frick says, quote, shelters aim to educate the public. You can make a big impact just by sharing a specific pet story or a rescue's information with your social network, end of quote. And now, in the special features section of the magazine, which I'm always intrigued by how the creative folks at Oprah Magazine managed to give us a wonderful interpretation of the Oprah O. When we turn to this page, we have a white neon light of the outline of the Oprah O. So it's an oval on the inside and almost a circle on the outside. This white light is in front of a deep, deep magenta background. So you get lots of pink glowing. And then there's a mirror at the bottom, so the image is partially reflected at the bottom of the page. January 2018, it says, what's the buzz? We're kicking off our year of big questions. Open your heart, open your mind, and let us light the way. If you like the intersection of sporty and stylish, you'll love the fresh weekend looks we have found. And if you're yearning to give your complexion a more vibrant glow, join us as we journey to, wait for it, your fridge. So those are the three topics in this section this month. And when we turn the page, we have the Wonder Year, and it has a great big question mark that fills the page, and there are pictures inside this. So we have Alec Baldwin impersonating Trump on Saturday Night Live. We have Putin on a horse, and we have the American flag. We have a woman holding a megaphone. We have a picture of the Capitol Dome. We have a woman in one of the pink pussy hats from the Women's March in a year ago. We have a picture of John McCain and part of a picture of a woman holding up a big piece of poster board that says Black Lives Matter. Are you feeling world weary? Restore your sanity and humanity in 2018 through the power of curiosity, openness, and awe. And introducing this, we have on the other page, to the left of this big question mark, a picture of Oprah staring serenely into the camera, her hair full of big curls, and she's wearing a red stretchy dress with lots of ruching. It's kind of a wrap dress with lots of ruching. Every momentous exploration, pivotal social movement, ingenious innovation, and soul-stirring journey began because someone asked a question. How can we change things? Where does this lead? What's possible? What's next? In mind, heart, and spirit, human beings are compelled to seek answers. The year that lies ahead gives us a remarkable opportunity. We may be living in uncertain times, but uncertainty also contains possibility. It's where great discoveries begin, and whether we want to change the world ourselves. What if, instead of fearing the unknown, we could embrace the incredible adventure of trying to find out? What if we could set aside judging, think less about what we know, and more about what we can learn? In the spirit of discovery, we're making 2018 the year of big questions. Questions about our highest purpose and deepest truths. How we can find peace and do better and love more. We're kicking things off with a celebration of what it means to question everything, to examine our lives and challenge our assumptions, awaken to everyday miracles, explore mysteries, and say to the person across the table, "Can you help me understand?" A more meaningful existence is yours for the asking, so we invite you to read on and consider this. What if a question could change your life? And on the next page, ask, and ye shall perceive. James E. Ryan, Dean of Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of Wait, What? And Life's Other Essential Questions, makes the case for curiosity. James says, as a kid, I loved to cross-examine my parents about everything. Why we ate liver? Why my mom thought Ronald Reagan would make a good president. Why my dad thought he'd make a lousy one. I never ran out of questions, which is why my father told me I should go to law school. Now, I teach law, and I still have a lot of questions. Being inquisitive is essential for a lawyer, but I believe it's crucial to success in just about every area of life. The right questions help teachers spark curiosity, give leaders a way to find solutions, and make us better friends, parents, and partners. Sometimes we're afraid to ask because we don't want to admit what we don't know. I see this in the classroom all the time, yet it never fails that when one person finally says, "Okay, this might be dumb, but," everyone else starts nodding as if to say, "Thank goodness." Next time you're in that situation, be the person who asks. You're almost certainly not the only one who's wondering. Instead of worrying about having all the answers, I'd like to suggest that we spend more time thinking about asking good questions. By that, I mean honest ones, posed because we are genuinely seeking to know. This could be as simple as saying to a friend, "Really? How are you doing?" Or asking someone in trouble, "How can I help?" This question acknowledges that the person needs assistance, signals that you're willing to offer it, and humbly suggests that she knows best what she needs. Contrast, "How can I help?" with the polite thing we often say, "Let me know if I can help." It's the rare person who will come back with, "Actually, you can." We're living in a time when there aren't as many honest questions as we might hope for, especially in public conversation. Often we're only partially paying attention to someone's response because we're busy thinking of what we want to say next. Or we're making statements disguised as questions, hoping to entrap the other person. But when we dismiss as ignorant those who disagree with us, we keep ourselves in the dark. One of the best questioners I've ever witnessed is former U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. When he questioned lawyers, he was never bombastic or intent on making his own arguments. Time and again, he would respectfully say, "Counselor, could you clarify your point?" More often than any of his colleagues, he would break open the case by finding the single question at the heart of it. Making the effort to hear someone else's viewpoint might not change our minds, but it can more fully inform our own judgment and help us better understand one another. It's just as important to listen carefully when we ask questions of ourselves. For instance, what truly matters? This is a powerful question, but only if it's an honest one. You may believe your family matters most, but if you look at how you're spending your time, you might discover that you're not living in a way that's consistent with that answer. We find out what we really value in the daily decisions that we make. So we might do well to stop occasionally and respectfully ask ourselves, what truly matters? Asked regularly and fearlessly, it is the single question that will help you get to the heart of your life. And when we turn the page, our next contribution is called Uncommon Knowledge. As a contributor to two podcasts from the Fun Facts website, How Stuff Works, Food Stuff, and Brain Stuff, Lauren Vogelbaum has learned there's nothing trivial about having an inquiring mind. Lauren writes, assumptions are foolish at best. Throughout history, so many great discoveries happened because someone challenged their preconceptions. For hundreds of years, Europeans were terrified of tomatoes because they thought they were toxic. If one brave person hadn't dared to try them, we'd be living in a world without pizza. Fighting preconceptions is even more important when it comes to people. Health research has taught me that while similarities exist across certain groups, every person's system responds in its own unique way to everything she experiences. You can't assume you know someone just because of a demographic like religion or race. People are beautiful mysteries. Curiosity also fights fear. My father was recently diagnosed with Creutzfeldt-Jakob, a fatal degenerative brain condition that's related to mad cow disease. Shortly after his diagnosis, I was looking into the dairy industry for a foodstuff episode on yogurt, and it led me to research the mad cow scare of the 90s and early 2000s. It was frightening to read about the disease, but also comforting to deal with hard facts instead of big, terrifying unknown. Whenever I'm facing something scary that I'd like to shy away from, I try to do the opposite and delve right in. In my crazy dream job of researching cool stuff, I've come to understand how much questions connect us. Every single object around us is the result of millennia of human innovation, and every single person who's touched it has her own story. Take the plastic your phone is made of. If you investigate, you realize it's a petroleum product that was once a fossil, which was once a living thing. It could have been a palm tree, or a dragonfly, or a Tyrannosaurus millions of years ago. And now it's your cell phone cover. And it's someone's job to make the molds that produce it. That's so wild. It never fails to blow my mind. It's like that old Carl Sagan quote, "We really are star stuff." Our next contribution is called Free to Be You and Me. Damning other people creates hell for ourselves, says Gabrielle Bernstein, author of Judgment Detox, Release the Beliefs That Hold You Back from Living a Better Life. Gabrielle writes, every one of us struggles with judgment. We judge other people's politics, tweets, parenting choices, maybe so often that we don't even notice anymore. It's just a habit. But as someone in her 12th year of sobriety, I believe the cycle of judgment is more like an addiction. Judging gives you a hangover. When we judge, we get an instant hit of self-righteousness, but subconsciously, we know we're separating ourselves from who we really are, compassionate, kind people. As a result, we feel guilty once our high wears off. And to avoid that feeling, we have to judge someone else. This cycle weakens us mentally and physically. Judging isolates you. We develop addictions because we're trying to numb a core wound, which is usually rooted in childhood. Maybe someone told you that you weren't good enough, or you experienced some other kind of trauma that left you feeling all alone. To avoid experiencing that pain again, you project it onto others by pointing out their flaws. Our fear leads us to attack by reenacting the trauma of the past that only creates more loneliness and disconnection. Judging prevents healing. You have to be willing to look at your darkness in order to see the light. That's why the first step in a judgment detox is just to witness it without blaming ourselves. We judge because we're separated from love. To stop the cycle, we have to cultivate self-love. The second step is to honor that core wound. Next time you have the urge to judge, ask yourself what moment from the past is triggering you to feel this way. When we can understand ourselves, healing begins. And finally, judging leaves you powerless. Many people feel safer when they judge, as if they're controlling their circumstances, but hatred only creates more hatred. Those hours you might spend fuming about the news, for instance, could be used in a more positive way, like volunteering for a cause you care about, engaging in creative projects, or spending quality time with people you love. Recovering from judgment addiction gives us back our power and lifts us, everyone around us, too. To heal the world, we have to live the truth in every corner of our lives. Recovery isn't easy, but when we let go of judgment, we make room for love and joy. It's like staying sober. You can't really enjoy a drink again because you know how good it feels to live without it. And then, listen up, America. People in this country agree on something. We need more civil political conversation. O wanted to hear your thoughts on the state of our union, so we posted a survey on Oprah.com to ask about your most passionate views and pressing concerns. More than 1,300 people responded, liberals, conservatives, and independents alike, and unsurprisingly, they had a wide range of opinions. We'll be sharing more results in future issues. But they were remarkably unified in their longing for the days when we could at least agree to disagree. We asked, what is your biggest concern for the future? Many of you cited terrorism, economic security, and the environment, but the largest group chose the political divide / partisanship, and that group was 24%. Patricia Nelson of Charlotte, North Carolina said, I want to understand why some people feel as they do, but often when I ask for more information, I'm shut down with name-calling or blocked. Sarah Harris of Los Angeles says, I flat out won't share who I voted for in the last presidential election because people clump me in with the worst offenders. I find this painful because there's been a big and necessary battle over gender, sexuality, and immigration issues, but I feel the unforgiving vitriol coming more from people on the ground than the politicians who get accused of spewing it. Amy Roberts of Fort Collins, Colorado says, both Democrats and Republicans sit in their little echo chambers with their fingers in their ears, while those in the middle, independents and other parties, are silenced. Our national dialogue has devolved into Facebook memes and one-liners. Meanwhile, it seems the majority of Americans are sick to death of both parties. Carol Todd of Coos Bay, Oregon said, there's no discussion. It's my way or the highway mentality. And finally, Emery Chapman of Newcastle, Maine says, when I start tensing up, I take a breath and pull myself back, knowing that the universe is running on time and everything is exactly as it should be. I bless the person and remember we're all one regardless of the illusion of division. I believe this is how we affect change. And now we have a two-page interview here. A quest called Tribe. Oprah talks with author Sebastian Younger, who is challenging us to rethink some of our culture's most fundamental ideas about purpose and prosperity. For his most recent book, the best-selling Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging, journalist Sebastian Younger went in search of answers to some very big questions surrounding personal fulfillment, community, and our search for meaning. His provocative findings captivated readers, including Oprah. Oprah says, quote, "I was so struck by the ideas in this book that I wanted to tell everybody," end of quote. First, though, she called Younger to ask a few questions. Oprah, you write that for hundreds of thousands of years, humans lived in close-knit social groups or tribes, living and working side by side, sharing resources, protecting one another. But modern society is just the opposite. We have fewer chances to help one another and be helped, and as a result, many of us are depressed and divided. In America, these divisions are only getting worse. Is that why you wanted to write the book? Younger, honestly, yes. I got the initial idea after I spent time as a journalist with American soldiers in Afghanistan. We were completely isolated, shoulder to shoulder in the dirt, firefights almost every day. But there was a strange sense of well-being. After the deployment, a lot of guys actually said they missed it. It reminded me of something I'd heard from a mentor of mine who was half Lakota Sioux, half Apache. He said that in frontier America, white settlers would run off to join the Indians, but Indians never ran away to join the whites. I wanted to understand that reluctance to return to our society. Military life is like tribal living. You're rarely alone. You share almost everything. You depend on each other for safety and survival. Compare that with modern life, where we're all in our separate houses and are rarely called on to help one another. Oprah, yes, now we're all behind our own hedges, but I grew up in a community where you literally went over to your neighbor's to borrow sugar, and if somebody was in trouble, the rest of the community gathered around that person. Younger, ironically, though our society of affluence brings safety and stability, it doesn't bring psychological health. As wealth goes up, suicide and depression rates tend to go up. I read one study that compared women in North America with women in Nigeria, and the group with the highest rates of depression was urban North American women, which is the wealthiest. The lowest rates were among rural women in Nigeria. Now, there are obviously huge stresses that come with poverty, but the poorer the society, the more collaborative people have to be. Collaboration is what humans are wired for because evolutionarily, that's how we've survived. One interesting thing I found was that if you take an affluent modern society and collapse it during a crisis, like a war or a natural disaster, people began relating in a more ancient, organic way. They're functioning in small, interdependent groups and putting others first. And another irony is that even in terrible times, cooperating makes people feel good. Oprah, I thought of your book during the Houston floods. On the news, there was a young African-American man who had been out rescuing people for 24 hours straight. He had a glow about him. A reporter asked, "Aren't you exhausted?" And he said, "No, this is what Texans do. In the worst of times, people get to feel the most of themselves." Younger, if hardship brought out the worst in people, the human race wouldn't have survived. Right after 9/11, for instance, the murder rate actually went down in New York City. In World War II, during the Blitz, the civilians of London were bombed almost every night for 6 months, but psychiatric admissions declined. Often people who live through the trauma are nostalgic when it's over. When I went back to Bosnia 20 years after the brutal civil war, even people who had been badly wounded told me they missed those times. They were missing their more courageous selves. Oprah, you write that the most profound question is, what would I risk dying for? Younger, The natural answer is for my family. But for most of history, we didn't live in families. We lived in small communities that gave us our sense of safety and place in the world. So the natural answer would be for my people. The blessing and the tragedy of modern life is that we don't need our community to survive anymore. When we lose that idea, we lose a sense of who we are. Oprah. Isn't that the ultimate expression of patriotism, the idea of dying for your country? And yet it feels like there are multiple tribes within the tribe that's supposed to be the United States. Younger. Soldiers join the military to serve their country, but when bullets are flying, it's hard to fight for an abstract notion like patriotism. They're fighting for the people standing next to them, and it doesn't matter who's a Republican or a Democrat, and who's black or white or Christian or Muslim or gay or straight. If Congress and all Americans could manage to ignore those differences, we would have a perfect country. But somehow we cannot rise to that level of nobility. Oprah, you write that we are living in a country that seems to be at war with itself. What can we offer one another instead of contempt? Younger, I would never want to pass a law limiting freedom of speech, but that doesn't mean we have to condone statements that undermine basic national unity and respect. Imagine being asked to defend a country where some citizens say the man in the White House isn't their president, as some of my fellow Democrats do. Or a major presidential contender accuses the commander-in-chief of not even being a U.S. citizen. Those kinds of statements erode trust in our democracy, and it's up to both parties to publicly reject them. We have to restore confidence that we are a nation that loves and believes in itself. Oprah, one part of tribe that especially resonated with me was the loss of our, quote, shared public meaning, end of quote. How can we find it? Younger, we have to develop it for ourselves. Right now, America doesn't ask us to do anything besides pay taxes. We don't even have to vote. But as psychologists will tell you, when you have to sacrifice for something, you value it more. What about national service for young people? Everybody between 18 and 24 could spend a year or two working for this country in some capacity. It'd be an amazing thing, and it would mix this country racially, culturally, economically. Oprah, what an interesting idea that community service isn't something you do because you committed a crime. It's part of our system. And our final response from Younger. I got that idea from my father, who was a war refugee. His family escaped Spain during the Franco regime and fled to Paris. Then they were lucky enough to escape the Nazis and make it to America. He was a pacifist while I was growing up during the Vietnam War, but in 1980, when I got my draft card and said I wasn't going to sign it, he said, "Yes, you are." In Europe, there are thousands of graves of young Americans like you who died liberating the world from fascism. You don't know that the next war won't need to be fought. This is an amazing country, and you owe it something. End of quote. So then I signed the card with enormous pride. I felt like I was part of something noble. Sebastian Younger is the author of a number of books, including The Perfect Storm, and co-director of the Oscar-nominated documentary Restrepo. Our next contribution is called The School of Life. According to wisdom researcher Monica Ardelt, Ph.D., the wisest people have more questions than answers. Like intelligence, she writes, wisdom has no single definition, and different researchers measure it in different ways. I believe it has three dimensions: cognitive, reflective, and compassionate. The cognitive is about the desire to uncover deeper meaning. A wise person is always questioning as she seeks to better understand herself and others. She can also accept that life is unpredictable, so she'll never fully understand everything. Even Socrates said that because he could admit his own ignorance, he might be the wisest man of all. To understand the world, you need to be open to multiple perspectives. That's why we need the reflective dimension, which is about putting our ego aside to get the bigger picture. Wise people cannot only imagine situations from another person's point of view, but also see themselves through someone else's eyes. They have enough self-awareness to acknowledge their own positive and not so positive qualities, and they take responsibility for their own lives. Thinking less about yourself and more about other people usually fosters kindness, which brings us to the compassionate dimension. I've been asked whether this dimension is necessary, and my argument is that without compassion, a person cannot be wise. Someone who has great insight into human behavior but doesn't care about others would make a good cult leader or an unscrupulous used car salesperson. Ironically, studying wisdom doesn't make you wiser because you can't find it in books. We gain it by learning from our experiences, even the smallest ones. When someone cuts you off in traffic, do you get riled up? Or can you take a breath and practice equanimity? And one of the most important predictors of wisdom is being open to new things, so stay curious. A wise person never stops asking. Now, in the minute we have left in this installment, we'll hear some reader comments about the November issue of Oprah. Olga Zumski of Malvern, Pennsylvania says, "I am so grateful for the November O. Glennon Doyle's The Beauty Complex should be the commencement speech at every all-girls high school graduation, and Amy Tan's profoundly emotional words in Pen Pals. How very brave of her. Kudos also for including so many women of color." And Jennifer Allen of Portland, Oregon says, "I was delighted to see the pomegranate and orange peel fizz mocktail recipe in your November issue. A lot of people in my life avoid alcohol for medical, religious, or personal reasons, and it's great to have this new recipe to add to my hosting repertoire. I also tried the apple cheddar Dutch baby recipe. Magnificent." And the color-blocked shawl Oprah wore on the November cover was a Insta hit. Sylvia 0726 tweeted, "Love that wrap scarf, Oprah. Gorgeous." And we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.